Today is Friday, April 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been moved out of the ICU.
His culture minister said Thursday he was, quote, stable, improving, sat up, and engaged with medical staff.
Plus, early voting begins in South Korea.
Face masks, mandatory, plus plastic gloves, and sanitize before you cast your vote.
And ways of coping with anxiety in the age of COVID-19. Those stories and more are next. It's been 100 days since the World Health Organization was first notified about the novel coronavirus. So, what do we know at the onset, and what knowledge have we since gained? For that, I spoke to Dr. David Weber, a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina here in the U.S.
We knew very quickly it was the coronavirus. In addition, we had the 1918 flu pandemic to help guide us in some of these issues. So very quickly, we knew a number of things about this virus. We knew that it would be droplet and direct contact transmitted, meaning within 6 feet and touching, and likely to be indirect to contact. We knew that coronaviruses survived on inanimate surfaces for hours to days. But we also knew that alcohol as an antiseptic was active against this virus, and standard disinfectants were quite active against this virus as well. We knew very quickly that it came from bats as the ultimate reservoir. We also knew, of course, that we did not have a vaccine and that there were no proven effective treatments for this virus. We knew the symptoms would be predominantly respiratory. But what did we learn over the next period of time? Well, we have learned that the infectivity of this virus is similar to influenza, maybe a little bit higher. We knew from SARS and MERS that there were so-called super spreaders, meaning infecting more than 10 people. We knew from SARS that this virus, even without any therapies or vaccines, could be contained to some extent by physical distancing, a term we prefer to social distancing. What else have we learned recently? Well, just in the last month or so, we've learned that a substantial number of people may become asymptomatically infected. We believe that some of those asymptomatic infections can transmit. We also know a number of people can be pre-symptomatic transmission.
So what don't we know, and what do we still need to learn?
First of all, we don't have a vaccine, and it probably won't have one for 12 months because one will have to be developed, and two, testing a vaccine takes considerable time. We do know that there are a number of drugs, potential therapeutic drugs, that are active on the test tube or animals. Multiple clinical trials are underway, but we don't know yet which, if any, of these drugs will be useful in combating COVID. While we think both pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic transmission may be possible, we don't know how frequently that occurs. We don't yet know how likely we are to see second and third and fourth waves of this virus in the future. We still are just beginning to learn more about the risk factors for severe disease. Certainly older age, particularly over 70 and then over 80, is a major risk factor. Underlying diseases, heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease are risk factors as well. But we haven't quite determined exactly the interaction of all these risk factors and how additive they are. And then some other risk factors, such as asthma, how impactful that is. We still need to determine what the impact is on pregnant women. Certainly, if a pregnant woman becomes severely ill, that has severe detrimental effects on both the woman and the fetus. But other issues about are there potential small amounts of transmission through breast milk or intrauterine to children? And finally, obviously, the pandemic is now worldwide, and we're using physical distancing. We still have to determine how long that physical distancing needs to be maintained and what the triggers are for allowing people to stop physical distancing, go back to working, revive our economies.
In terms of testing, U.S. President Donald Trump said that it was very unlikely that every American would be given a COVID-19 test.
Do you need it? No. Is it a nice thing to do? Yes. We're talking about 325 million people, and that's not going to happen, as you can imagine. and no, it would never happen with anyone else either. Other countries do it, but they do it in a limited form. We'll probably be the leader of the pack.
So the question I have for you is, how prevalent should testing be?
So there are two types of tests. We have PCR tests that actually look for virus, and those are important that we have enough testing capacity to test all of those who have symptoms. So we know who's ill, who's not, particularly when we start beginning to develop therapies. And there are already many clinical trials, and obviously you need to test them to see if they're infected, to put them into an appropriate clinical trial. And those tests need to be more widely available so that every person who has symptoms could be tested. Certainly anybody who's sick enough to have to come into a healthcare facility, either as an outpatient or inpatient, we need to be able to test. Similarly, we need to have enough test capability for when we have infection in closed populations, cruise ship, nursing homes, college dorms, hotels. We need to be able to test all the individuals there to learn who's infected, who's not not currently infected. As a separate issue are the serologic tests, which don't measure actual virus, but measure the antibody's response to the virus. And those are just coming on board now. And those really are most useful, not for acute diagnosis, but to determine the factors that you've mentioned. What percentage of the population's been infected? Has it affected differentially, as we now believe, African-Americans and other minorities? How about immunocompromised patients? Has it been more, and there have been higher attack rates in urban versus suburban or rural areas? What about the differences in age? And for the serologic tests, no, we don't have to test every single American. Much like the Gallup poll, we need to test enough people randomly chosen from the population and from substantial subpopulations such as minorities, women and men, people with underlying disease, a variety of ages, to be able to statistically be able to look at those groups. So that number will not be in the millions. It will be in the thousands to potentially over 10,000 people. That can be determined statistically by epidemiologists and statisticians.
That was Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina, Dr. David Weber. More than 1.6 million people have contracted the disease, and that is according to a Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's health is improving, and he's been moved out of the intensive care unit where he continues to be treated for COVID-19. On the government's plate, in his absence, a review of lockdown measures and a colossal overdraft. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has that story.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is getting better in intensive care, where he is battling COVID-19. His culture minister said Thursday he was, quote, stable, improving, sat up and engaged with medical staff. The 55-year-old was admitted to hospital on Sunday and has spent 3 nights in emergency care. But he has not been put on a ventilator. His stand-in, Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, faces two main challenges. One is reviewing Britain's stringent lockdown at an emergency COBRA meeting. No decision was expected Thursday, but the Mayor of London and other senior officials say the measures will stay in place. As Britain enters what scientists say is the deadliest phase of the outbreak, with deaths expected to rise over the coming Easter weekend. The head of Britain's National Health Service, among many, saying social distancing must go on, though the number of new infections and hospital admissions may be starting to flatten. Hopes of the coronavirus crisis nearing a peak boosted Britain's stock markets. Also on the government's plate, how to finance a vast increase in spending to support a shuttered economy. The world's fifth largest economy is facing what could be the worst hit since World War II. The Bank of England has agreed to expand the government's overdraft, temporarily financing government borrowing if the funds can't be raised on the debt market. The last time that happened was during the financial crisis of 2008. The government has made historic spending and tax cut pledges to try to shield companies and workers from what could be the biggest downturn in more than a century, ramping up borrowing plans by tens of billions of pounds. UK hospital deaths from COVID-19 rose a daily record of 938 to more than 7,000 as of 2 days ago.
That was Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder. Detainees in Australian immigration centers are pleading to be released because of COVID-19 fears, as there's been at least one confirmed case of the novel coronavirus in the detention network. Inmates say it is impossible for them to self-isolate and protect themselves from the disease. Phil Mercer reports that in protest, some say they are on a hunger strike.
Detainees at the Villawood Immigration Centre in Sydney fear an outbreak of the new coronavirus. Inside the facility that houses more than 400 people would be impossible to control. They're pleading to be released. Some say they're so desperate, they've gone on a hunger strike.
We're not going to break or wreck anything, but this is the only form of way that we can reach out is by striking like this, to don't eat. In order to get some form of attention.
No eat, no drink.
No eat, no drink. We're sick of being in the dark and being in the shadows. We are human beings. So we urge you, we're pleading with the Australian government to act now. The time is now before it gets here and it's too late.
In a letter to the Prime Minister Scott Morrison, detainees insist they're living in a potential COVID-19 death trap.
We ask the community and the Prime Minister and the lawyers to help our family and help us before the disease comes inside the detention and sweep everybody.
This COVID-19 virus, it's taken you out there. It hits in here like it is already, the rumours are. We're all gone. We're all going to die. We just get buried with nothing. They might as well just come and shoot the lot of us now.
The government insists there are established plans for dealing with a potential coronavirus outbreak within Australia's detention network. A spokesperson said detainees showing symptoms of COVID-19 would be quarantined and tested. There are about 1,440 people, including those from Iran, New Zealand and Sudan, being held in detention on the Australian mainland. 40% are asylum seekers, while around 600 are being held for visa breaches. The average length of time in detention is more than 500 days. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The western U.S. state of California has more than 100,000 homeless residents, and officials are struggling with how best to help them during the COVID-19 pandemic. They face a dilemma. Where should the homeless go? Cram people into shelters and risk more infections, or move them into hotels and trailers, or simply leave them in their tents and cars? For the homeless, the pandemic is an additional challenge to a hard life on the streets. VOA's Michelle Quinn takes things from here.
That one. And then, do you like black or camel? I got two masks for everybody.
Black.
Andrea Henson is handing out masks this morning to homeless people who live along the freeway in Berkeley, California. A homeless activist and civil rights lawyer, Henson also gives out food, vests, and tents, and cleans up camps.
It doesn't make sense for us to be giving them all these things to stay safe and clean when they live in squalor.
California, one of the richest economies in the world, has the greatest number of people in the U.S. who live outdoors. And now it has COVID-19, which threatens to hit the most vulnerable the hardest. Some cities and counties here have placed sick homeless people and those exposed to the virus in hotel rooms. They have rented trailers and opened up convention centers for beds. But many are still outside.
This is a different approach than the hotels, helping realistic risk mitigation in this environment, where you could stay in your, have a new tent, stay in your area, self-isolate, get supplies, because it's really hard to get into these hotels, you know?
Joe Pendleton lives in his van with his dog, Grizz.
I think it's definitely a lot safer to isolate in my van than in a big public space with shared air systems.
Pendleton, an Army veteran, works with volunteers to set up makeshift hand-washing stations at homeless encampments.
We've come up with our own system of moving people through camps if we suspect they're sick, so they're quarantined from everybody else. We're homeless, not helpless.
Jessica Prado is a Lyft driver who has stopped working because of the pandemic. She lives in a recreational vehicle.
So if anything, we have spread information within ourselves, you know, make sure that our neighbors know what's going on, make sure that they know about the shelter in place order, because a lot of my house people don't have phones, so they cannot stay up with the news.
Officials in some cities are looking to buy hotels so that after the pandemic, people aren't kicked back on the street. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Berkeley, California.
And still coming up on the program.
We need to have things that are successes. We need to have things that are finished. We need to be able to say, oh, look at that, I did that. Because that's what helps mitigate the anxiety we're experiencing.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Saturday, April 11th marks the 50th anniversary of the launch of the Apollo 13 mission, which NASA calls its successful failure.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here. This is Houston. Say again, please. Houston, we've had a problem.
The Apollo 13 crew included Jim Lovell Jr., John Swigert Jr., and Fred Hayes Jr. On April 13th, 1970, while the mission was heading to the moon, an oxygen tank in the Apollo service module ruptured and exploded. The extent of damage to the service module wasn't known until later when the command module separated from it. The planned lunar landing and activity were aborted. With the help of their talented team in Houston, the crew sheltered aboard the lunar module were able to maintain necessary resources to bring the spacecraft and its crew safely back home to Earth on April 17th, 1970. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Throughout the world, many countries are scheduled to hold elections in 2020, and South Korea is getting that process underway. Ryan Brooks from Reuters News has these details.
Face masks, mandatory, plus plastic gloves, and sanitize before you cast your vote. South Korea kicked off early voting for its parliamentary elections on Friday, and they're the first elections to open among countries hit hard by the coronavirus crisis.
It was a little uncomfortable since I had to put on plastic gloves, but because you've got to vote, it was reassuring.
The election itself is actually next Wednesday, but officials are hoping people will take advantage of the option to vote early in thousands of stations across the country. And in doing so, reduce crowding at polling stations in a few days. The polling sites on Friday were disinfected, and anyone whose temperature was too high were directed to special booths. 8 polling stations have also been set up specifically for the more than 3,000 coronavirus patients getting treatment, as well as hundreds more medical staff. South Korea once had the largest number of COVID-19 cases outside of China, but infections are down after widespread testing and social distancing. On Friday, it only reported 27 new cases, and the city of Daegu, once the biggest epicenter outside Wuhan, reported 0. The success of South Korea's fierce battle against the virus may translate into a boost for President Moon Jae-in and his ruling party in the polls. He cast his ballot early in front of cameras on Friday. Before the outbreak, his party's ratings were battered by a stagnant economy and domestic scandals. But a recent poll showed their approval rating had jumped by 15%.
That was Reuters' Ryan Brooks. The United States has taken a different approach than some European countries in providing relief to workers and industries that have been shut down to contain the spread of the coronavirus. While countries like Germany and France are reimbursing businesses to keep workers on the payroll, VOA's Brian Patton reports the U.S. has mostly adopted to increase government assistance for millions of workers once they have been laid off from their jobs or lose employment entirely.
The U.S. unemployment system has been swamped after nearly 10 million workers were idled in the last month due to the coronavirus outbreak, and millions more file for jobless benefits.
I actually haven't gotten an unemployment check yet. The system's overwhelmed. You can't call in. If you call in to the employment, they just hang up on you.
Around the world, widespread economic shutdowns imposed to slow the deadly pandemic have left many businesses on the brink of collapse. In parts of Europe, governments are paying companies to keep workers on the payroll to stabilize the economy and ease financial anxiety during the public health crisis.
Then the worker has some place that they know that they're going to go when the crisis is over, and their health care is taken care of.
But in the U.S., most workers are eligible for assistance only after they lose their jobs. Many also lose their employer-provided health care coverage, and some groups like undocumented immigrants are excluded from receiving unemployment benefits. The federal government is sending $1,200 directly to Americans with moderate incomes, and Congress is negotiating a second round of stimulus payments. The U.S. government does have one program aimed at keeping workers on the job, loans to small businesses that are forgiven if employers retain workers during the pandemic.
The reason why everything is so convoluted is probably because they don't want to have a series of incredibly perverse incentives that might lead to businesses not behaving normally once they reopen.
In some states, the National Guard is helping distribute food to those in dire need, as many waiting for assistance struggle to pay for basic needs.
I have no idea what we're going to do about rent the next month, where that's going to come from, or our electricity bill.
Once bureaucratic delays and bottlenecks are resolved, financial assistance should help unemployed Americans survive in the short term. But concerns about a slow economic recovery leave many wondering if their old job will be available after the pandemic ends. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
The COVID-19 pandemic has upended people's lives across the globe. In many countries, schools and businesses are closed. Families are separated. People are afraid of getting the virus, and they are worried about their loved ones, that they will perhaps get sick and die. There's a lot of anxiety coming with this pandemic, but there are ways to cope. More from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Empty shelves at the grocery store were one of the early signs that the new coronavirus was spreading in the U.S. People began buying and hoarding more food and supplies than they needed. Ken Yeager is the clinical director of the Stress, Trauma, and Resilience Program at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
And when people's coping mechanisms are overwhelmed, they begin to do things to manage uncertainty.
Yeager says there are better ways people can cope with the stress.
They can ground themselves in conversations with family members, knowing that they're home and safe through the variety of communication methods we have today.
With video chats, people can see their family members and friends, even if they're far away. They can also use exercise to help them cope. Scott B. is a psychologist at Cleveland Clinic who specializes in treating anxiety.
We know that that is useful for our physical well-being and our emotional well-being. It's great research on physical exertion being a good treatment for depression, for anxiety as well.
Yeager says another important thing is to set goals, even small ones.
We need to have things that are successes. We need to have things that are finished. We need to be able to say, oh, look at that, I did that, because that's what helps mitigate the anxiety we're experiencing.
He also says it helps to look back at the way we've handled other challenges.
All of us are growing the most when we're living outside of our comfort zone. And certainly this is a time where the overwhelming majority of us are finding ourselves outside of our comfort zone.
B says despite the uncertainty and stress, don't forget to laugh.
Doses of humor are good for us. I think it is a way to activate good brain chemistry and actually protect ourselves with better immune function. Humor is really good medicine.
B says when you share an experience, even from a distance, it's a way of bringing the community together. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition. on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.